Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Today we're going to be exploring some of the best shows on offer in London this season. It hasn't been the best summer in British records so far, so all the more reason to duck inside and soak up some art. Taking me through some of these exhibitions is the editor-at-large for the art newspaper, Jane Morris. Welcome to the show, Jane. Good to have you with us. As always, a few gallery visits on the way, but let's start with a couple of sort of art news nuggets. Could be a new section, who knows? What's been making headlines this week? Interesting about Magnus, this app which has been pulled. Tell us a bit more about this one.
So Magnus Resch, he's been doing all sorts of things in the art world. He runs something called Larry's List as well, and he wrote a book quite recently about how to run a gallery. He set up this app, and it's a price data app. And the idea is that people can take pictures of works of art and then find similar works and find out what sort of price they are. Some of the data is coming from data that he's gathered himself, or rather his team. Apparently there's about 80 people gathering data. But I think a lot of the data is also user-generated. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this has been causing a bit of a stir because galleries, as I know, having been covering them for the last too many years that I'd like to mention, galleries are not very keen in general on releasing price information. So this is obviously one of these things that's trying to be a disruptor in the art market. But what's caused a bit of a fuss is that Apple has temporarily pulled it. According to ArtNet, now ArtNet runs a rival price data, so you know we should bear that in mind. According to ArtNet, three galleries and then Artsy, and which also runs a price data, and another price data service called ArtFacts, between them, complained to Apple, and as a result, Apple suspended this service because they said that some of the data had been taken from their services. Now, Artsy has since refined its position and said it only had some copyright issues over images and that it did not, in fact, complain to Apple. This is a very long-winded way of saying, basically, there's a war going on in the price data world. Magnus, who runs this, says that the service will be restored very shortly. So There's a big sort of war going on at the moment around who is going to provide price data. Is anybody going to provide price data? Particularly, is anyone going to provide price data when galleries don't want them to?
Well, there's several interesting facets of that, Jane. And I guess one thing that intrigues me is this an issue with the art world, I guess, broadly, struggling to adapt with the pace of technological change? Or is it more about, and well, there's another sort of news nugget of the week which might speak to this as well, this issue of transparency about prices. What are the, I guess the galleries in particular, what are they more unhappy about?
Well, I suspect transparency more than anything. They don't like giving out prices for a whole number of reasons. They often say, oh, it's the artist doesn't want to reveal the price, and maybe that's true. Often it's really because there is no single price. And This is what's emerged with this other story, which is Mary Boone Gallery is suing an art advisor. And Mary Boone is saying that the art advisor said that the two works by Kors that she bought were going to go to a famous collector, we don't know who, and as a result she was given a substantial discount, and the price for the two works was discounted from $350,000 to, I think, $290,000. And then it turned out that this work appeared a few months later in a French gallery, and so Mary Boone is saying that the art advisor misled her, the art advisor is saying quite the opposite, that she never revealed a buyer, and so on and so on. Basically, what's really at the core of this is that galleries like to pick and choose who they sell work to when an artist is very successful, and they adjust the price accordingly. So the Tate will pay less than, you know, Joe Bloggs off the street. If the artist is very famous, there's probably a long waiting list as well. So Some collectors are more valuable than others. Hence, they don't like to reveal prices. That's one of the reasons they don't like to reveal prices.
And what do your instincts tell you? I mean, do you think dealers should dealers get a say? Is that reasonable? Or again, is this a market that's matured way beyond, you know, these individuals having that kind of control?
Yeah, I mean, I obviously can't pretend to be independent, really, because I'm a journalist. So, of course, I'm going to say price transparency. However, it's widely felt that the art market will not be a robust and trusted market unless it becomes more transparent. Meanwhile, the advent of technology means that all sorts of people are beginning to come up with ways to shake the control that galleries have over images and prices and how their art is talked about and discussed and printed. So I think that this is a change that galleries are going to have to get used to, and I think it would be wise if they embraced it and got on with it and accepted that the art market will have to become a more open place.
And that maybe remains to be seen. We'll revisit this perhaps in future meetings. As promised, let's talk about some specific shows though now. And we'll begin at the Barbican, I think, Jane, shall we, for a survey show of Icelandic video and performance artist and painter Ragnar Kjartansson. it's a pretty special exhibition. This has had a, you know, pretty universally positive sort of review. We've got troubadours singing, spitting mothers, concert performances. Walk us around the show. What delights are in store?
Well, I think this is the hit of the summer season. In fact, I think it's one of the best shows I've seen in many years. Kjartansson's been kind of bubbling under for a while. He was born in the 70s. I think he's nearly 40. But his big breakthrough was 2009, when he represented Iceland for the first time at the Venice Biennale. And there are works from that installation. What he did was him and a friend occupied a palazzo, and a lot of his work is thinking about what it means to be an artist. And he has quite a, I would say, ambivalent relationship with the idea of being an artist, because he kind of clearly loves it, but also is uncomfortable with it and with the idea of it. So basically, they took up residency in a palazzo. They smoked and drank themselves, probably into quite a pit, I would imagine. They basically smoked and drank for the whole of the Venice Biennale, which is something like 144 days. And every day he made a painting of his friend. So this was one massive glorified paintings studio art fest. And in the Barbican, you can see the results, the 144 paintings. Now, he's not a great painter, it has to be said, but that's sort of part of the point. But this is a great sort of work about the romantic myth of the artist. And that runs through, I think, pretty much everything we see there, whether it's these performances, which is these very handsome young male singers who are sitting like troubadours, again surrounded by bottles of beer. Sadly, no cigarettes, no smoking now allowed in galleries, if they ever were. But we used to be allowed to smoke outside, but no longer. They're sitting playing music in the gallery, and behind them is a video of his mother. It's a real video of his mother, film of his mother and father. His mother is a famous actress, and basically they're singing about, she's having a sort of mad affair with this man by the dishwasher, and these boys are singing in a very mournful kind of way and romantic kind of way, "Take me by the dishwasher." And it's really quite something, because it sounds ridiculous, and there is a sense of it's a bit ridiculous, and he has a very fine eye for the humorous and the absurd. And yet it's actually very poignant as well, because his parents separated. It's actually called a memorial for a marriage. His parents separated. The music is quite mournful. There's something very nostalgic about it, because it makes you think of beautiful young hippie men with nothing better to do than sit around strumming their guitars in bedrooms. And it's quite a powerful piece. And I think you see this again and again and again in this exhibition. You can't decide whether it's funny. Some of the pieces are very moving. Some things are very beautiful, because he may not be a great painter, but he's a brilliant filmmaker. Mm-hmm. There's one of the absolute stars, I think, of this for me is upstairs. There is a beautiful film of a performance by the indie band The National. It was filmed over 6 hours. He's into durational performance as well, like Marina Abramović. But again, with him, you always wonder what the point of this very long durational thing is. You think that in one sense he has a romantic idea of that kind of endurance, but he also knows it's pointless. Anyway, upstairs is this fantastic film of The National singing a 3.5 minute song called Sorrow. But they sang it for 6 hours nonstop at PS1, and this is the film of it. And it's really mesmerising. And there's something so mournful and yet so pointless about it. And yet it's absolutely addictive.
Tell me a little bit more about, is there a question here about Ragnar's sort of accessibility in a way? And you talk about his ambivalence about being an artist, but you also mentioned he clearly relishes it. And he also outwardly, there's an explicit sense of him enjoying the performances, whether it's his champagne cork popping or him clearly enjoying the fruits, as it were, of his labour. Do you think that helps to, it draws the audience in? Because there is a sense of being along for the ride. And even if it's The National, who never leave anything behind in their performances for 6 hours, they look broken at the end of that video. But there's something that carries people along on a wave, whether it's that uncertainty about whether this is joyous or melancholy. There's a powerful, I don't know, sense of being part of this sort of roller coaster that he's on.
I think that's very true. I also think he's brilliant with music, and so that really helps. I think, as I say, that his films are really, really beautiful to look at. I think that, I mean, every time I've been in there, and I've now seen the show a couple of times, there've been a lot of younger people in there, and I think he's very good, you know, and I think this is one of these occasions where He's a very, very talented artist, and he speaks to people. And as a result, it's not as inaccessible as it might sound. I think people really do get it.
Let's talk a bit about the visitors, because it'd be nice to throw in a bit of an audio cue here, Jane, as well. But before we take a short listen, though, tell us a bit about the visitors specifically.
This is a beautiful piece. And I must say, the Barbican is not always the nicest space, but it's brilliantly installed for this show. It really works for video. There are 9 film screens in a darkened room, and each one is showing a musician playing in this 200-year-old, rather decrepit, but once very grand ex-colonial house up in upstate New York. And so each musician is sitting by themselves, and they're singing and playing, though, in unison. They've got headphones on, so that must be how he's made it work. They shot it in a single take, and as I say, it's this extraordinary, almost like lonely orchestra. It's absolutely beautiful to look at, and it sounds wonderful.
A beautiful, lonely orchestra. Let's take a listen. So that's a little extract of The Visitors from Ragnar Kjartansson. I guess we have to be fairly unequivocal. This is a show people need to go and see. It's on at the Barbican until the 4th of September. No reservations. Get along.
That's absolutely the
Jane Morris verdict.
Go and see it. Allow time for it. If you want, think about the fact that you may want to go back. And it's quieter on a Monday and Tuesday. The weekends are pretty packed.
There we go. So that is on at the Barbican until September 4. Get to it. Jane, let's move on. Let's talk a little bit about Georgia O'Keeffe and Georgiana Houghton. We've got a couple of other summer shows. We're going to take a quicker wander around. Hard not to mention Georgia O'Keeffe, I guess, in the capital this season. Big exhibition at Tate Modern. Everyone's been talking about it again. What's on show here, Jane, and what's your take?
Oh, well, I think it's one of those important must-see shows. I mean, she's a major, major figure. She is currently the highest priced woman at auction ever. I think the image that's the cover image of the show, which is one of these big flowers, sold for, I think, $44 million a couple of years ago. Million dollars, that is. But this show is aiming to show that Georgia O'Keeffe is more than just flowers. Mm. And I think they do that very successfully. I mean, she was very famous in her own time. She had this very long relationship with the photographer Alfred Stieglitz. And she's famous for these big flower paintings. But what they've done is, it's a very thorough Tate show. You know, it's chronological and themes. So you move from the flowers to the landscapes, to the American architectural paintings. There's a lot about her life in New Mexico, where she ended up settling. It's a very, very good, very thorough survey show. You know, very good photography and background information, excellent catalogue. And just one of those shows you just got to go and see. She's a major, major figure of the 20th century, and this is your chance to see it.
And do you think that this helps to build a more complete picture of her? I mean, you mentioned already people have a sort of preconceived idea, and they say, oh yes, the flowers with these sort of labial images, it's all about repressed sexuality and all this kind of thing.
Absolutely, she absolutely
hated
it.
Do we have a better understanding now?
I think so. She absolutely hated that interpretation, although one can understand why that interpretation has been put on them. But it shows a much, much wider set of her work. Mm. And I think with the catalogue, it does explain why she's such an important 20th century figure.
Another, if not must-see, probably should-see. That's on at Tate Modern, the Georgia O'Keeffe exhibition, until the 30th of October. Last, but by no means least, let's go to the courthold for Georgiana Houghton's Spirit Drawings, a series of watercolours from the sort of late 1800s. Now, this is an interesting figure, without any doubt.
This is a totally quirky show.
Exactly. And so, clearly, yeah, an artist, a medium as well. And I guess this is one of those things where those two disciplines, if you call it, you can't really separate them.
No, you can't. So basically, she was born in the 1814, something like that. She lived in the 19th century, and she was an ardent and passionate believer in spiritualism. She starts doing these drawings, which she feels that sometimes she feels they're guided by the hands of her relatives. Mostly it's the hands of her relatives, but occasionally she feels that she's being guided by great artists, including Titian and Correggio. And the reason she's interesting is that these are really rather beautiful, abstract drawings. She put on a show herself towards the end of her life, I think in the later, 1871, I think, which nearly bankrupted her. The visitors were all given magnifying glasses. So the courthold has done the same. And it is actually worth looking at them through the magnifying glasses. They're incredibly detailed. I mean, obviously, the story is sort of bonkers, but they're incredibly detailed. beautifully composed and really worth looking at through the magnifying glass in detail. I mean, it's obviously a very, very niche show. I think the idea is to demonstrate that there were people before Kandinsky. They mention in this show Hilma af Klimt, who was also a sort of mystical type person. And there was a show of her recently at the Serpentine, and it was showing that she was making abstract work again in the 19th century. And I think the idea here is to show Georgiana Horton as a pre-abstract person working rather alone and working in this rather outside the system way. I mean, it's a quirky show. It's a fun show, and it's small. And if you happen to be in the area, it's totally worth seeing.
And that area is the Courthold. Until September the 11th, it's Georgiana Houghton's Spirit Drawings. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks, Jane Morris, for being with us, as always. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. Our producer was Holly Fisher. Join us again at the same time tomorrow for our music review. But for now, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.